Hello, my name is Gary Gramling of the Monday Morning Quarterback, and allow me to be the first to congratulate you on your decision to become an NFL head coach. On this podcast, we will lay out the simple four-step process you'll need to know on your journey from becoming a buzzy candidate, mastering the art of the interview process with a billionaire owner, closing the deal and winning over your fan base, and finally, managing the shame of your inevitable firing. At this point, I'd like to introduce my colleagues who will talk you through each step, Jenny Vrentis and Connor Orr. Let's start with part one, getting your name out there.
So, hello, everybody. Jenny, I think it's interesting, like, we found that having covered the league for as long as we do, this seems to be the hardest step for a lot of coaches, right, is to emerge as the buzzy candidate. And sometimes it happens due to happenstance. You happen to be the offensive coordinator of a really good football team. But there are all these extenuating circumstances. Do you get the time to talk to the media? Are you allowed to get out front? Do you have an agent who's working behind the scenes for you? So I feel like this is a really interesting sort of step one.
Yeah, and I think sometimes coaches who aren't the buzzy candidates have a lot of frustration because they're not doing anything wrong. They're just not the buzzy candidates. So it can be something that's entirely out of your control. Maybe you don't work in the Belichick or Nick Saban tree. Maybe you are a black candidate, not a white candidate. Maybe you are not related to somebody who's in the NFL. None of those reasons should make you not a buzzy candidate, but this is unfortunately how the hiring cycle works. But I think, Connor, one thing that you and I both know is the only time of year in which agents like to talk to reporters is coaching agents around this time of year, because they all want their candidates to be on somebody's list. So it is literally the only time of year when they are eager to call reporters back and start gushing about their various candidates. And sometimes they bring up a candidate and you're like, I've never actually heard anything good about this coach, but they're making them sound like they're the second coming of Lombardi. I'm not sure. So, you know, I could have gone a lot of directions there. And a lot of times it's just, that's how it works. You have an agent hyping a guy up. Their name is spread around media reports. Team executives see the name in the media and think that they're the best guy. And it goes from there.
It really is sort of the strangest, like, inverse pyramid hiring process of all time, right? Like, it's almost like it's the tail wagging the dog. And that's how it's been forever. I don't know how you reverse the process without removing owners from every NFL franchise. But I do find it interesting, having talked to a lot of coaches who had the benefit of being the buzzy guy, right? And you have that sort of, I'm not going to call it an easy rise, but you have more of an escalator ride to the top. And then there are other coaches who are certainly talented, but for example, you know, there are coaches who maybe at the positional level are prevented from speaking to the media. They don't even get to be out front and get their face on a camera. They don't get to talk to reporters. And, you know, this could be for myriad reasons, right? One, the coach wants to be the unilateral voice and face of the organization. And two, the coach really likes the assistant coach and doesn't want him to leave. And I do think that there is some, like, there are some issues there, right, where coaches struggle to get that publicity because there are times when somebody's extraordinarily valuable to you, you don't feel like promoting them, you can't promote them, but you would like them to stay exactly where they are. And you run into these situations that are really just like, it's a coach at his own expense hampering somebody else's career. And we've seen that countless times, whether that's outright blocking someone from interviewing for a job or just taking away their chances to get out front of a camera.
Yeah, I remember when I was reporting the story on Bill Belichick and Nick Saban's friendship a few years ago, one of the anecdotes that came up was Belichick respected Saban so much while they were working together for the Browns, 4 years together, he decided that his assistant coaches would no longer speak to the media. And the team's head of PR told the coaches that, and Saban laughed because he knew why it was. He knew he was a good coach and he didn't want to lose him. So Saban said in reply, I don't plan to be the defensive coordinator for the Browns for the rest of my life, so I'll probably be talking to the media. And he, sure enough, was quoted in the Akron Beacon Journal 2 days later.
I mean, it's weird. Like, I feel bad for a lot of coaches, right? And so for people to kind of understand the overarching process here, I mean, there are like four or five very major players in the coaching search business, right? And then if you're not represented by one of these people, your climb becomes even steeper, you know, and then the access to these, you know, discussion points among reporters and the, you know, the ability to get in front of other people in the media, all that stuff. And so a lot of times, you're left in this uncomfortable situation where, you know, some coaches don't have a lot of media finesse, right? They don't trust reporters, or they don't know that they should trust reporters, or they've been told their whole life that reporters will do something bad if you talk to them. And so they just kind of live in this little shoebox environment. And, you know, I've had dinner with coaches who the whole time they just spend looking around, you know, is anybody else here? Is anybody else going to see me doing this? And it's a weird thing, right? Because they have to take it upon themselves to get the publicity that they feel like even their agents, even if you have an agent in a certain sense, is not going to be able to get you above that certain level, because the agents at the top are able to also not only promote their guys, but tamp the other ones down by, you know, using sort of these anonymous sources and saying, oh, well, you know, I heard that guy's got some problems or something like that. And you don't have to define it. You don't have to say anything. But all of a sudden, it makes all of us stop and be like, whoa, is there anything wrong with this person? You know what? Maybe he shouldn't be on the list.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Connor. I remember talking to one coach several years ago who had one agent who wasn't one of the handful of most powerful agents in the coaching world, and they switched agents. And I remember this coach said, I feel like I'm getting into bed with the devil, but it's my only way to get a head coaching job. And that's the landscape, right? Is that power is consolidated in a handful of power brokers, and you have to work with these specific agents to even have a chance. And there's a lot of conflicts of interest at play. These agents, because there's a few that are so powerful, they represent a ton of coaching candidates, and they don't necessarily care who gets which job. They just want the highest number of their clients to get jobs. So maybe that's one of your clients is a head coach and they take another of your clients as a coordinator. They basically are trying to align the pieces so that they get the most money out of any given coaching cycle, which therefore may not be the best for any individual client that they're representing. But if you don't go with this handful of power brokers, then you may not have a chance to get a job at all.
Yeah. And we'll get more into that in step three. But another interesting thing there, full disclosure, as the person who puts together SI's head coaching list and is sort of, you know, privy to these conversations, I find it interesting that there are agents who are quite powerful, and there are agents who are trying to get their clients noticed in a good-natured way. And then there are agents that I've called who represent a pretty sizable handful of people and say, I'll say, hey, do you think that anyone merits consideration to be on the list? And they'll say, not really. And I said, really? Like, it, you know, and it's surprising. Like, there are bad agents, just like there are, you know, bad coaches and bad football players. And so it really is a murky process. And yeah, it creates probably a lot of complex and complicated feelings.
Self-proclaimed NFL insiders on Twitter are citing league sources and mentioning your name. Good! Before you know it, you'll be seated before, among others, a billionaire owner with little to no football background who will decide whether you are the right man to take over a proud 4-win franchise. Hopefully, you've already learned how to pronounce the word analytics. And remember, the best answer is the one the very powerful people before you want to hear.
Okay, so we already discussed how do you get to the interview room, and now we're on to what do you do when you get there. And I think certain aspects of the process have shifted through the years. I remember a few years ago, the big shift was going from the candidates making a presentation to the teams dominating the conversation. But ultimately, the team that you're interviewing with probably wants to know a couple things. And foremost among them is this coach going to win me some games? Now, how they get to that conclusion is a little bit different, Connor. I think we've heard some more problematic things over the years, which goes into what you were saying earlier about owner decision-making, where they hire the person that reminds them of their son, which is why we have too much homogeneity in the head coaching ranks. Sometimes they just want what everybody else has. So we saw that with the chase for the next Sean McVay the past few years. And sometimes they just go in with a preconceived notion of who they plan to hire and everyone else is a sham interview, aka the Raiders with John Gruden a few years ago. But assuming that this is actually an open hiring process, which is probably a factor in whether you're taking the interview. I mean, I'm sure you've heard this too, Connor, that a lot of coaches want to know, like, is this actually an interview? Like, do I really have a chance for the job? Or am I, in the case of minority candidates, am I just meeting the helping the team meet the Rooney rule? Or in the case of, like we said about the Raiders a few years ago, do they already have a guy in mind and they're just making it look like they're talking to other people? But assuming it is an open interview process, when you go in the room, you want to present a clear vision for what you will do with the team. That includes who will be on your staff. I think that's one of the most important things for owners and decision makers is, are you bringing a good staff with you? What will you do with the roster? Not even necessarily what players you would cut, but maybe more so, how would you manage a tough situation? Maybe there's a player that's been disgruntled and wants out, or maybe there's a question at the quarterback position. And what kind of culture do you want to build? Sometimes it's as simple as, how will you win a game? And I remember talking to decision makers a couple of years ago, and someone said to me that you'd be surprised how many coaches walk into the interview room and they can't answer a simple question, how are you going to win a game?
I do love that aspect of it. That's one of my favorite things. Like, especially last year, I remember talking to a lot of people who were very nervous about making their candidates seem interesting enough over Zoom, because a lot of these interviews were going to be conducted virtually. And so there was a big focus on, like, virtual presentation, like components of it. Could they include video and, you know, kind of moving PowerPoints and anything to sort of make the coaches seem less interest or more interesting in a virtual setting? But that goes down to, like, you know, I've heard of coaches who have worn very strange things, like, to interviews and like not worn a suit. And then everyone's just kind of like, what's the deal with that? And like coaches who have like randomly struggled with like they try to like, I'm going to be the coach that brings the energy up. And then like almost pulls like a Howard Dean. Like, do you remember Howard Dean, the presidential candidate who like fell off the map? I think it was the year, maybe the John Kerry year, or it could have been Obama in 08, right? Was it John Kerry or Obama? But he initially started as the front runner, and then he did that like, thing at the pep rally. He was doing his pep rally, and he's like, we're going to go to Iowa, and we're going to go to Mesa, and we're going to go here. And then he just went like, and everybody thought it was really weird, and then he just dropped off the map of candidacy. And I heard of a coach like doing that, which was like, if you think about it, being in a room full of these stuffy white owners and then just being like, we're going to run the ball. And then everybody just looks at you like, you know, you have an antenna growing out of your head. I thoroughly enjoy all of that, because as reporters in press conferences, there are so many times when coaches put us in an awkward situation, and it just makes me feel better to know that at some point they got put in a similarly strange and awkward situation with someone that it's sort of like weird for them to be talking to.
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those things where until you've done it, until you've been through an interview process, you don't actually know what to do. You can prepare as much as you want. You could think you'll know what it's like, but it's probably always a little bit different. And I think that is why sometimes younger candidates or candidates who haven't been through the cycle before sometimes do take interviews, even if they're a sham interview or even if they're checking a Rooney Rule box, because maybe you just want to get a little bit experience at doing it. And then once you are more experienced and further along, you will then reject those sham interviews. But like anything else, sort of being in the room and seeing what it's like, I think is helpful. And I know that agents do a lot of prep with their candidates. I've seen these surveys that some agencies send out. It's like a head coach questionnaire with a bunch of different areas that they could be asked about, and you want to make sure you have material to respond with. So tell me about your coaching experience. Who's the best head coach you've ever worked with? Which program would you model yourself after, or culture and football philosophy? What are the team's core values, and how would you create and maintain an effective team dynamic? I'm actually reading off of one of these questionnaires. You know, tell me about treating your coaching staff as another roster. Who will oversee quality control? How will technology be used for your playbook? This is probably a little bit of an older questionnaire. Communication, what will your regular schedule be like? Your off-season schedule, draft, free agency, mini camp, training camp. I mean, all of these things. So you want to be able to have an answer to everything. But I think that part of the preparation where it gets hard is if you're a coach whose season is still ongoing. And we've heard a lot of discussion about this in recent years. You know, should the NFL make it so that no coaches can be interviewed until everybody's season is done? That seems like an unlikely step that they would adopt, but it can be somewhat distracting if your season is still ongoing and you might not have the time in between your preparation for playoff games to study the roster of the team you're interviewing with and have a plan. And so sometimes agents will do that research for their clients themselves. Maybe they'll call players on the active roster of the team that their coaching client is interviewing with. I mean, a lot of agencies are big agencies. They also represent players. Maybe the agents themselves represent players. Maybe they'll study the roster or film or give their client or their candidate things to take into the interview process. But it would be chaotic to be interviewing for the most important job of your life while you're also preparing for one of the biggest games you'll coach in. I mean, I still remember I was in Foxborough a few years ago. It was the year the Patriots played the Rams in the Super Bowl, and I like check into my hotel near the stadium, and in walks Chris Greer. And I'm like, why is Chris Greer in Foxborough? Oh, probably interviewing Brian Flores, which he was. And obviously they hired Brian Flores, but like, you're Brian Flores, you're at Gillette Stadium all day preparing for the Super Bowl. And then at night you pop over to this nearby hotel, you cram your interview in like a couple hours that night. I mean, certainly not the ideal circumstances to be interviewing under. Although of course the fact that you're about to coach in the Super Bowl gives you a little extra shine too.
For sure. And you referenced this before, Jenny, but and another part of this process, right, is getting all of your ducks in a row, right? You're going to have to present an assembled staff at the time of the interview. And I think what's really interesting is I've compared it a lot to if you're a president, right, and you're considering making a run for president. You know who's going to be in your cabinet. You have a general idea of who's going to be in your cabinet before you run. And there are coaches like across the board, like, you know, active offensive, defensive coordinators, former head coaches who we know for a fact have their staffs, like a shadow staff, like set up right now. Like, and so they will be ready to go in the interview. And it's like, well, I'm going to take him from here, and I'm going to take him from here, and I'm going to take him from here. But that also presents a lot of issues, right? Because not only do you have to include people who you think are going to propel you forward in the interview process, but once you get to that level in the coaching business, there are a lot of favors that need to be paid back, right? There are a lot of kickbacks that kind of need to be made throughout this process. And so I remember, for example, one coach on a roster telling me, like, yeah, our play caller is, you know, there was a very obvious familial tie here, and this is why this happened, and someone's uncle, brother, sister, cousin, dad helped out the head coach at one point in his life, and now we're saddled with this like incredibly destructive person on the roster. And so what are we going to do about this situation? And so it's hard. I mean, you have to, you know, the price that you pay when you get into this business is to understand that like no decision that you make in a lot of ways is fully yours, right? Because there are the favors you directly have to pay back, and there are the agencies that you have to pay back. You have to have you don't have to have a certain number of guys from the agency on your staff, but they're trying to piece you all together, like you mentioned, Jenny. And so it's got to be incredibly chaotic, and you have to tell some of your best and closest friends, guys that you've planned on coaching with for your entire life, sorry, dude, you know, this just isn't going to happen.
You're getting the job. We knew you could do it. Now it's time for the fun part, And by fun, we mean not enjoyable in any way. The introductory press conference. Avoid that flub, misspeaking in any way will haunt you for years, and come prepared with your best knee-biting proclamations.
So, Jenny, this is my favorite part. This is, I think, why I fell in love with the coaching business, is the introductory press conference. I think that there is a formula to this, right? If you're a coach, you get a little choked up, you get on the verge of, maybe not even on the verge of crying, but on the verge of crying. You point out your family, you say we're going to be a tough football team, and then you get out. But a lot of coaches don't do this. For example, Ben McAdoo decides to walk in wearing, I talked to him about this afterwards, like he lost like 90 pounds in between like the time when he was started, last time he had to wear a suit and his first introductory press conference as a head coach, and just decided not to buy another suit. And so just like walked in to the most fashion conscious city in the world in a gigantic like David Byrne talking head style suit. And it was hilarious. And I felt very bad for him that he got made fun of for it, and then got made fun of when he changed his hairstyle the next year to sort of appease everyone who was saying he was unfashionable. But this is a ruthless process. It often has nothing to do with how you'll actually succeed as a coach. I think there are a lot of coaches who are great at press conferences or horrendous, awful people and bad head coaches. And then there are coaches who are really bad at press conferences who are tremendous people. And this is where a lot of stuff gets conflated, I find, because owners want to win that press conference. And there's a certain reason why, you know, I'm thinking of some of these coaches who have been in the cycle for years and years and years and who just don't get jobs because they're afraid that he won't win the press conference. And it's such an absurd thing, but it matters. It matters to people, how owners, how these guys are perceived at first glance.
Yeah, my theory, Connor, is that your success as a head coach is inversely proportionate to how much people say that you won the press conference. So the coaches that come out there and are talking about biting kneecaps, or everyone says, oh my God, they captivated the room, this is exactly the right guy, or what a rah-rah thing, I want to go run through a wall, that those coaches always flame out. But you also don't want to be on the other extreme. Like, you don't want to have a situation where, like, unfortunately, in the case of Adam Gase, where his eyes became a meme, and that's just not a great situation for anybody. And it probably causes some personal stress. So you just kind of want to be somewhere in the middle, right? You just don't want to make a ton of waves. As you said, get in, get out, have it be somewhat neutral, answer all the questions, be congenial, but don't make a show either way. I think it probably matters, and yes, the owner wants to have a good start to this new era, and it probably matters a little bit with your players, but only if you don't make a fool out of yourself, right?
Correct.
Like, if your players think you're disingenuous from the start, that might stick. If you do something that's really embarrassing and unfortunate, they might wonder, how is this person going to leave the locker room? But otherwise, they probably don't care all that much.
Two more good don'ts for my list. There was one new hire. This was a couple years back now, a fairly long time ago. I'm not going to say the place or the exact position, but was overheard right after the press conference saying quite loudly to his family, don't talk to any of these people. They're not your friends. And then, like, so every reporter in the room was like, okay, like, it's going to be that. Like, this is kind of going to be our situation. And the other big don't for me, if you're a coach who spent the whole offseason talking about how much you've advanced as a human, don't then come to the introductory press conference and then say you lied about that entire process. So Mike McCarthy was written about quite glowingly as saying he watched every single play in football the year before. And then at his introductory press conference, someone said, Mike, that's amazing. Like, what did you learn from this? And he's like, well, I didn't really watch every game, every play from the season before. I just, you know, that's something you say to get a job. And it was just this incredible moment where it was like, wow, like, I guess you have to appreciate the honesty a little bit, but I would just lie, and I would say, like, I would pepper a little like spider 2Y banana on the guy and then be off on your way. But it did not seem like he had the finesse to get that done.
Yeah. I mean, not the time for confessions, not the time for airing of grievances, which we may have seen in the not too distant past when a coach went from one AFC East team to the other and just sort of, you know, took that chance to poo-poo on the last team. I mean, just don't try to do too much. Just try to stick to the middle. But I will say, Connor, the bar has been set pretty low with some of these college coaches. We saw Brian Kelly in the news this week for sending his players a text over Teamworks or whatever the software was. Basically, with a paragraph that was pretty disingenuous and meaningless. So, again, bar is set pretty low. It's not that hard to fly under the radar and escape from the opening press conference with not a lot of buzz either way. And that is the direction you should go.
Yes. Do not leave and then forget to tell all the kids that you're currently trying to lead to a national championship who have based a very major life decision on words that you have said to them. But that is the one advantage as a head coach, right, that you have in the NFL is normally you just get fired. You don't really bounce around to different NFL teams or unless you're traded or you're Doug Marrone. But yeah, this is that's one of those things that you have to keep an eye on. No airing of grievances, no lying about openly admitting that you lied. You know, just get in, get out, get on your way.
The moribund team you took over failed to win a Super Bowl in your first, second, or even third season. Clearly, things are not going to work out. At this point, avoid public appearances and hope you can leave with your dignity intact.
Wow, third season from our voice in the sky there. What is he talking about, John Gruden? Nobody gets three seasons anymore to not make the playoffs. But I've developed a very different perspective on the end. I've written some very like joking posts about it. There are some typical coach maneuvers that they do go through when I think they realize the end is near there. But I think my perspective has changed a lot in that, you know, there are a lot of people who's, you know, not, and I'm not talking from a head coaching perspective, but at the very bottom rung of the ladder, like some people whose dreams do die like that day. And it's a very like hard thing for them to accept. And like, there are people who aren't making anywhere near $1 million who have to like pick up their families and figure out new, you know, childcare options and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, is one thing that's important to consider. But at the top, I feel like the whole thing is very like House of Cardsian, you know, it's very political. You're trying to leave with your reputation intact. You're trying to preserve yourself for another job, another opportunity elsewhere. And it has to become very stressful and complicated, I imagine.
Yeah. And we talked in the last section about the difference from college and that there is less coach hopping. But I think in this case, that presents as a negative because there's only 32 head coaching jobs in the NFL. Whereas in college, there's a lot more programs, a lot of levels. You may lose your job, but still be able to coach somewhere else, a smaller school, or there's just more places to go. Whereas if you lose your job as an NFL head coach, you have a couple options. You can sit out for a year. You can return to being a coordinator. You can leave the business, right? None of them seem appealing once you've led your own team. And I think that's a difficult transition. And I think people have made mistakes in how they've handled it. I've always said that there was no way Rex should have gone directly from the Jets to the Bills. He should have taken time off. He should have reassessed. But in part, he did that, Connor, to your point, because he wanted to make sure that the coaches on his staff had another job because a lot of them, their contracts were up and they didn't have extra years and weren't going to get paid. So there are a lot of factors that go into it. But I think the reality is whether or not you succeed as a head coach does not entirely have to do with your ability to be a head coach. I think certainly you can control to some degree how well your team does, but there's also a lot of circumstances that are out of your control, largely how the organization is run, what the ownership is like. Are they giving you the resources you need to do your job? Are they willing to pay for the roster you need? Did they allow you to pick your own staff, or were you saddled with previous coaches to help the team save money? How much does ownership meddle in your decision-making? And all of those things are really hard to assess in the interview process. And I think because the interview processes can be so rushed at all levels of the sport, especially in the NFL, that you don't necessarily have a chance to assess all of that. And if you had more time and could compare offers and really think about where the best situation is, maybe you'd make a different or a better choice. But because decisions have to be made so quickly and everybody wants to have the chance to be a head coach, you jump at opportunities, even if the opportunity is flawed.
Yeah. And it creates an interesting scenario where I think that in a lot of ways as a coach, when things start to go sour, you do feel like, you do feel like you have no choice but to fight your way out, you know, but in a way that you need to preserve, like you said, whether it's Rex and you're trying to preserve jobs for an entire staff or your friends or your friends' kids or whatever it is, like, you know, you have to not only be cognizant of that, but you have to protect your reputation while also not like burning a bridge on the way out and making yourself seem like this rogue truth teller who's going to be a total wild card for another franchise, right? And so I think that's why it's very interesting, like in the waning months and weeks of a coach's career, you know, you often do see sort of those interesting leaks pop up, like, well, you know, X person wanted the star quarterback that was passed up for X person, and, you know, or X person was going to draft this person, but was told by the GM that he couldn't. And, you know, all of a sudden, like, you start to be like, huh, you know, maybe this is an effort to sort of protect yourself on the way out. I always, you know, if I'm an embattled head coach, always passively, aggressively blaming the general manager. You can't lose. I think it's a win-win scenario, you know, and you just, like, you bring up that GM's worst draft pick ever, and, you know, you use that as a launching pad for some sort of anonymous little thing that you're going to fling at a reporter and have the guy tweet out. So that's kind of my favorite move, but that's also, like, that's as close to the nuclear option as you're going to have as a head coach on your way out.
And I think the other thing to keep in mind is generally when a job is coming open, that team is not in a good situation. So maybe the roster needs a total rebuild, or maybe they are in a city that hasn't won in a really long time and can't seem to shake that losing culture. Whatever the case may be, you're going in to try to fix something. I mean, it's very rare that a coach retires on top or walks away and there's a franchise quarterback just waiting. I mean, those opportunities do sometimes come about. I mean, Matt LaFleur coaches Aaron Rodgers, for instance, but they're few and far between, and it very often doesn't work that way. So do you have a quarterback that can win games? And if not, can you find the right quarterback? And there again, Connor, you're relying on the GM to scout the right guy in the draft or make the right moves to bring a guy in. So it's not necessarily a straight line where you can say, I have all these ideas for the team, and I'm going to be able to execute all of them. It's not always about how good your plan is. Sometimes you're just not able to execute the plan for whatever reasons, even if you're trying your best. So I don't know. This section has a lot of empathy, I guess, for failed head coaches, Connor, doesn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, I think the ones that failed the right way deserve a lot of empathy, right? The ones that failed in a noble way, I think it's a very heroic thing not to be an evil dude on your way out, and it's very easy to be an evil dude on your way out. I've long had the argument that, like, in a lot of ways, I feel like the most successful of all time kind of coaches, like up on that hierarchy, you know, there are certainly some, you know, exceptions to that rule, but, like, you can't be like a normal, nice person. Like, you just can't exist that way as, like, a humane, like, I'm considering all of your feelings kind of guy for every single person you have to deal with. I think you need to, you know, the best of those coaches are a little bit like they can just shut off the part of their body that needs to feel things for other people or have concern for anybody else.
So the ideal way to move on from a failed coaching opportunity is to be a Bill Belichick or a Tom Coughlin and go on to another team and win some Super Bowls or a lot of Super Bowls.
Yes.
The worst way would be to never get a chance to be a head coach again.
Well, and on the to end on the best note, speaking of Tom Coughlin, the best way to do it is to, well, he at that point he was on his way to a different job but did not win a Super Bowl. But after he left the Giants, robotically walked off the stage, like turned towards his office, and then just breezed past the owner without even looking at him, like, and like as if he was like marching in formation towards the exit door. Just a brilliant maneuver, a performative gesture that was meant for everybody to see. Everybody saw it. It was wonderful, and you have the opportunity to do that as a coach. So make sure you have a little fun with it.
Especially have the opportunity to do that if you've won two Super Bowls.
Yes.
You are now fully prepared to embark on your likely brief journey as an NFL head coach. And be sure to listen to the next in our series of instructional podcasts, how to turn your thin coaching resume and a not quite burgeoning TikTok account into a career in sports media. The MMQB NFL podcast is Jenny Vrentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody, and our senior podcast producer is Dan Bloom. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts, and once you do, please leave a rating and review because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.